contrary to U.S. media claims, Tehran put forward no excessive demands that goes beyond the framework of the JCPOA.
برخلاف برخی ادعاهای رسانه‌ای طرف آمریکایی، ما هیچ گونه مطالبه زیاده خواهانه ای نداریم، هیچ گونه مطالبه فرابرجامی مورد ادعای آمریکا را نداریم. مطالبات ما کاملا در چارچوب توافق سال 2015 است.
امیر عبداللهیان's remarks came in response to U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley, who claimed that Tehran came up with new demands at the Doha talks. The U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price echoed Malley's remarks, claiming that Iran has consistently introduced extraneous demands, demands that, or issues that, go beyond the four walls of the JCPOA. Iran is pursuing the JCPOA talks, while Israel has been sounding the alarm about Iran, its regional influence, and its alleged efforts of weaponizing its nuclear program.
And Israel is far from wanting the interests of the countries of the region. On the other hand, we see that the countries in the region like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, they're talking to each other, they're meeting in Baghdad. They've met several times in Arab and Middle Eastern capitals. So they are capable of sorting out their problems. And therefore, any relationship with Israel would be detrimental and against the interest of the countries of the Middle East.
Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official has warned against forming alliances with Israel, saying that such moves endanger the security of the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says that any alliance with the Israeli regime, even of a non-security and non-military nature, will pose serious threats to the stability and security of the Middle East region. Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He underlined the emphasis on neighboring countries in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, asserting that Tehran's coherent policy towards its neighbors is to expand all-out and strategic relations on the principle of good neighborliness. Separately, Shamkhani warned that the Islamic Republic opposes any move that changes regional geopolitics. This was in reference to a so-called Arab NATO, plan that was a non-starter when it was introduced by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. This military regional alliance was due to Israel and the U.S. sounding the alarm over the perceived threat coming from Iran.
The Iranophobia is something very natural to happen in the West because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability. The UK Prime Minister fought as hard as he could, but he finally gave in. Boris Johnson has resigned as the Conservative Party leader. This will pave the way for a successor to replace him as a British Prime Minister after over 50 of his ministers quit the government. He will, however, continue as Prime Minister until autumn. A Tory leadership race will take place this summer, and the winner will replace Johnson by October. Boris Johnson's premiership plunged into crisis following the dramatic resignations of Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the Health Secretary Sajid Javid. Javid, who served as the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, made reference to Johnson's failed leadership as the reason for quitting his post.
And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough. Yeah. I believe that point is now.
Further resignations have followed, with the education ministers Will Quince and Robin Walker and ministerial aide Laura Trott quitting.
He had scandal after scandal, miscalculation after miscalculation. He's lost the confidence of, I assume, the country, going by the recent by-election results, and more recently, he's lost the confidence of many senior members of his government. with over 40 of them now resigning.
Johnson was under mounting pressure after apologizing for appointing MP Christopher Pincher to a role involved in offering pastoral care to his party, even after being briefed that the politician had been the subject of complaints about sexual misconduct.
He knew the accused minister had previously committed predatory behaviour, but he promoted him to a position of power anyway. Why?
They're looking at the future. They're looking at the next Conservative government being returned in 2024. I believe they feel that won't happen with Boris Johnson at the helm. Therefore, people are jockeying for position. The knives are out. It's a Caesar and Brutus type political ending of his career.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the scandals that surrounded him drowned his political life, and he found himself to have fallen out of favor with the general public in the UK. Prior to his resignation, a snap YouGov poll had found that 69% of Britons thought that Johnson should step down as Prime Minister. The timing of his resignation could not be any worse. The UK is experiencing a cost of living crisis like no other time in its history. Many Britons are struggling to cope with rising fuel and food prices. Economists say that the country is now heading for a sharp slowdown or possibly a recession.
He is, for his own political, selfish purposes, been running this country's economy into the ground, and worse, far worse, he has been threatening a peace process. That's all I've got to say.
And things will get much, much worse before the next general election. And I think regardless of who wins that election, we will continue to see an economic crisis.
Now with a new administration set to take the helm in September or in early October, the real concern for the UK is how it will cope with the economic crisis until then. This is not to dismiss the fact that there are no guarantees that the new administration will be able to deal with the economic onslaught that will be piled on it.
I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says the Federation will be a partner in the lawsuit filed against the Israeli occupation in the International Criminal Court. A member of the executive board of the Federation says the move came after the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate succeeded in persuading the Federation to file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. IFJ stated that the filing comes in light of the Israeli aggression against Palestinian journalists and people. Earlier, the Journalist Syndicate had said that it succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The circumstances of Shirin Abu Akleh's killing on May the 11th have been investigated by several international organizations. All concluded that it was a bullet fired from an Israeli rifle that killed the Al Jazeera correspondent and injured her fellow journalists as they covered an Israeli raid in Jenin. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probes, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. But the question is, will there and can there be accountability for the crimes committed by Israel?
And the absence of punishment shows hypocrisy, double standards, and deception and lies. So this is an opportunity for journalists to present all of the best documented evidence, research, discovery that they've done about crimes against humanity that the Israeli apartheid regime has committed. And the more international they go, the louder they go, the more they invite other countries to be participants, to join the lawsuit against Israel, the more you're building international consensus in support of the people who have been violated, dehumanized, killed, robbed, or in other way injured by this grotesque apartheid Israeli policy and agenda of genocide, bigotry, and destruction. So it's a very essential step, and I'm glad they're taking it.
Earlier this month, Palestinian officials handed over to U.S. forensic experts the bullet that killed Abu Akleh. But despite all the evidence pointing fingers towards Israel, the U.S. said it could not reach a definitive conclusion on the origin of the bullet. Meanwhile, Abu Akleh's family have expressed their anger over the U.S.'s disregard for what several courts and rights organizations have stated and its failure to accept that its ally has murdered a journalist in broad daylight. The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says that Israel was guilty of the crime and expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into Palestinian journalist Abu Akleh's killing. The U.S., on the other hand, has not condemned this act, yet aside from saying there needs to be an independent investigation, raising questions about whether the U.S. is seeking the truth or to protect its ally.
Well, absolutely, the U.S. is guilty of supporting the regime. The U.S. is guilty from enabling the regime to engage in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The U.S. has been guilty of stealing money from the American people and giving it to the Israeli apartheid regime and giving them weapons and, in fact, looking the other way when Israel had developed nuclear weapons, but that's another story. But Israel's crimes and abuses against the Palestinians, against the Syrians, against Lebanon, against all sorts of countries and nations and peoples, the U.S. is the partner in crime that is responsible. And if the U.S. does not hold a moral standard and a very clear objectivity and a dedication to truth and justice, then the U.S. is showing that it has no dedication to truth and justice, but instead has a dedication to lies and crime.
The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measures, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel. Yet no one, including the United Nations Security Council, has used any of its tools to ensure its resolutions. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has ruled that it has a mandate to investigate the occupied territories and has accepted the Palestinians after they were granted non-member observer status at the UN. This comes despite Palestinians' inability to join the ICC, as Israel is not a member and Palestinians do not qualify as a sovereign state. A new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, which requires the full or partial disclosure of previously unreleased information and documents controlled by the U.S. government upon request, offers the first official confirmation of Pentagon's use of the secretive 127E authority in multiple countries. 127E is one of the several virtually unknown authorities granted to the Defense Department by Congress over the last two decades that allows U.S. commandos to conduct operations on the fringes of war and with minimal outside oversight. And now, the report indicated that American troops conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world between 2017 and 2020. The document also shows that at least 14 127E programs were also active in West Asia and the Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. Separately, Joseph Votel, a retired four-star Army general who headed both Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in West Asia, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E so-called counter-terrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen.
The actual main purpose of U.S. Special Forces is to train and educate foreign fighters, and so they've done this in places that we would never that the United States people would never support in Africa, Central America, and places like that. And in fact, we created the School of the Americas, which trained Central American people to how to torture people properly.
The 127E program, an obscure program that even U.S. lawmakers are not familiar with, one that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by, with, and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. But all this only seems to be another term for waging a proxy war in another country through the use of local forces. The origins of the 127E program can be traced back to the earliest days of the US war in Afghanistan, as commandos and CIA personnel sought to support militants there. Army Special Operations Command soon realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new proxies and was forced to rely on CIA funding. This prompted a broader push by SOCOM to secure the ability to support foreign forces in so-called missions, a military corollary to the CIA's use of militia surrogates. First known as Section 1208, the authority was deployed in the early years of the Iraq invasion, according to a former senior defense official. It was ultimately enshrined in U.S. law under USC Title 10, Section 127E. But so far, the U.S. waging of proxy wars and its use of local forces to achieve its aims have been costly for countries targeted by Washington.
I guess I would use the example of the Philippines, where Duterte, who was a very right-leaning president, kicked the United States Special Forces out, even though they were operating in his space. In support of what he was doing, he kicked them out because he just didn't want that element in his country. American foreign policy is insane in every way that it possibly can be.
Critics in the U.S. have also contended that, due to a lack of oversight, 127E programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders, on the other hand, claim it is crucial to combating terrorism. But so far, the U.S.'s proxy wars in most countries where this program has been implemented, including West Asian nations like Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Lebanon, have mostly been witnessing instability, which is more likely than not a direct result of the program and proxy elements and fighters.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect for property. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of respect for property in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic text, we see that respecting others' life, others' property, others' honor, others' status in the society, this is something important in the Islamic text. And Islam talks about it. And especially Quran is teaching us about respecting others' property. We have many narrations which talk about this thing, and therefore we must respect them and we must save them. We cannot just live a life in which we are thinking about ourselves and we are not respecting about the other's property. Maybe I'm bringing my car out of a parking and I have touched or accidentally my car has been touching another car which is making a scar or a scratch on the which is making a scratch on the other cars. Maybe the door or bonnet or maybe any other part of that. Therefore, it is necessary for me to tell the person who is the owner or leave my number over there because this scratch has been made because of me. But generally, we see some people when they do such a thing and they see there is no one around them, they run away. This is not been taught in the Islamic text. Islam says that even if there is no one, you should remember that Allah sees you, Allah is watching you. Therefore, I must leave my number there so that this person who is coming, I can apologize that person. This is a property of that person. And if I'm making a loss to the property of the others, I'm responsible. Why? Because on the day of judgment, I'm accountable, I'm answerable to what I have done in this life, and therefore I need to be very much careful in regards to the other's property. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of respect for property in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that in Islam, we have the teachings where it says that you need to respect the other's property and you should not commit anything or any action that brings a loss to the other's property. Similarly, I need to be careful about my own property as well. I cannot just misuse them. I should use them in a way so that I am taking care of them. On the other hand, we see that in the narrations, for example, from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he was at the Hajj and it was the day of Eid, the 10th Zilhajj, he gave a sermon. In that sermon, he said that "Inna hurmata amwalikum alaykum wa hurmata dima'ikum." Your properties, the hurma or the respect of the properties is necessary upon you. Similarly, the respect of the blood or the life of the people. It is just like the respect of this day on which we are celebrating Eid. The way on the Hajj, we do not commit sins. We are forbidden from many things which were halal when we were not performing Hajj. Therefore, we are respecting this month. We are respecting this ritual of Hajj. We are respecting the day of Eid, and we are not fasting on the day of Eid. Similarly, we need to be careful. We need to be very much careful in regards to the property of the people. When we are dealing with the people, we should save their property. And if there is any damage that is happening through us, we should pay off the damages, because this is a right of the people. This is the right of that property which is upon us, and we are questionable for all these actions that we are performing in this world. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
While Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman were key lawyers for former US President Donald Trump and his campaign, respectively, and Jeffrey Clark was a senior Justice Department official, the trio played big roles in a brazen multi-front drive not to certify some of Joe Biden's electors, but bogus ones for Donald Trump. We have prepared for you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, "Lawyers Feel Heat as Legal Net Tightens on Trump Plot to Overturn Election." Former prosecutors say an accelerating Justice Department investigation into a fake electoral scheme to help Donald Trump overturn the 2020 election, plus exclusive testimony from January 6 hearings, have created intense legal heat for the lawyers Jeffrey Clark, Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, who were key players in the abortive effort. While Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman were key lawyers for Donald Trump and his campaign respectively, and Jeffrey Clark was a senior Justice Department official, the trio played big roles in a brazen multi-front drive not to certify some of Biden electors but bogus ones for Donald Trump. That could fuel charges against Trump, who they collaborated with for obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress or defrauding the United States. Legal experts say recent Justice Department actions, including seizing electronic devices of John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark, coupled with some evidence at committee hearings, are increasingly likely to spur charges against the three lawyers related to the drive to replace electors Biden won in seven states with fake electors for Donald Trump. The Justice Department's expanding criminal inquiry became palpable on 22nd of June when FBI agents raided Jeffrey Clark's home and separately seized John Eastman's cell phone as grand jury subpoenas involving the scheme were served up on top Republican figures and Trump allies in Georgia and Arizona. In another stark sign of the legal jeopardy Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman face, recent House committee hearings into the attack on the Capitol offered evidence that both lawyers sought pardons from Donald Trump, presumably tied to plotting strategies to block Biden's certification by Congress on 6th of January 2021, and fiery speeches they gave along with Trump at a rally on their lips before a mob of Trump allies and supporters attacked the Capitol. The legal threats facing Jeffrey Clark were underscored at a 23rd of June panel hearing by scathing testimony from former top justice officials about Donald Trump's plotting with Jeffrey Clark to elevate him to acting attorney general to push the fake electoral scheme by falsely claiming in a proposed letter to Georgia officials that the Department of Justice had significant concern about election fraud there and in other states. The former acting Deputy Attorney General, Richard Donahue, was scolding as he detailed Trump's efforts to replace the acting Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, with Jeffrey Clark in late December 2020, and to pressure state legislatures to reject Joe Biden electors by promoting baseless charges of widespread election fraud. Richard Donahue recounted how he warned Donald Trump at a bizarre 3rd of January White House meeting that was attended by Jeffrey Rosen, Donald Trump counsel Pat Cipollone and other top lawyers that elevating Clark to be acting attorney general would spark mass resignations and Clark would be left leading a graveyard at the Justice Department. Pat Cipollone, who was recently subpoenaed by the House panel, also threatened to resign if Jeffrey Clark replaced Jeffrey Rosen. Further, according to shocking testimony on 28th of June by Cassidy Hutchinson, a top aide to the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Cipollone warned her early on 6th of January of potential criminal liability for Trump and others if Donald Trump went to the Capitol as he had discussed doing, and asked Hutchinson to please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol. All of it adds to potentially grave consequences for the three lawyers. Michael Zeldin, a former Department of Justice prosecutor, said the strong evidence presented about the fake electoral scheme at a recent House committee hearing, including testimony by senior Justice Department officials, laid the foundation for charging Trump's legal advisers, John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani, and possibly Jeffrey Clark, with multiple state and federal crimes, including obstruction of an official congressional proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States, false statements in connection with the fake electoral scheme, and election fraud. Michael Zeldin added, "The cumulative evidence presented over the course of the hearings paints a picture of a president who was told explicitly by multiple people that he'd lost the election and that once he exhausted his judicial remedies, losing nearly 60 cases, his continuing pressure campaign to prevent the orderly transfer of power was illegal. Yet Trump and his attorneys persisted." Other former prosecutors stressed that the FBI raids to obtain Jeffrey Clark and John Eastman's phones indicate the investigations of the two lawyers have escalated. Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan, told The Guardian, "Search warrants of Jeffrey Clark and John Eastman's phones means that a judge found probable cause to believe that evidence of a crime would be found on each of those devices. John Eastman's exposure to criminal charges has been palpable and growing for months. In March, a federal judge, David Carter, in a crucial court ruling involving Donald Trump's legal advisor, John Eastman, stated that Trump, more likely than not, broke the law in his weeks-long drive to stop Joe Biden from taking office. In a civil case which resulted in an order for John Eastman to release more than 100 emails he had withheld from the House panel, Judge David Carter wrote, "Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history." Other revelations damaging to Donald Trump and John Eastman emerged at a mid-June House panel hearing with Greg Jacob, the former counsel to former Vice President Mike Pence, providing detailed testimony about how Eastman and Trump launched a high-pressure effort to persuade Mike Pence to unlawfully block Joe Biden's certification by Congress on 6th of January 2021. The John Eastman pressure included the scheme to substitute pro-Trump fake electors from states that Biden won for electors rightfully pledged to Biden. Greg Jacob testified that Eastman acknowledged to him that he knew his push to get Mike Pence on 6th of January to reject Biden's winning Electoral College count would violate the Electoral Count Act, and that Donald Trump, too, was informed it would be illegal for Mike Pence to block Joe Biden's certification. In mid-December of 2020, at least 59 Republicans from states that Trump had lost falsely asserted and signed legal documents that they were duly chosen electors for Trump in the Electoral College. Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan, said former prosecutors say potential charges against Trump and his top lawyers have increased in part due to the powerful details that former Department of Justice leaders testified about on 23rd of June, involving how Trump pushed to weaponize the Justice Department to facilitate the fake electoral scheme. Barbara McQuaid noted that the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, months ago confirmed Department of Justice had received evidence from state attorney generals about alternate slates of electors and was investigating. It appears the Department of Justice is now issuing subpoenas regarding this episode. One could imagine each link leading to the next and possibly all the way to Donald Trump. On top of Trump's involvement in the fake electors ploy, former Deputy Attorney General Donald Eyer, who served in the George H.W. Bush administration, told The Guardian that overall, the evidence is increasingly showing Trump's culpability. Donald Trump had extensive involvement in long conversations where he was personally working intently to overturn the election. Donald Eyer's point was bolstered by Cassidy Hutchinson's eye-popping testimony about Trump's knowledge of and indifference to the large cache of dangerous weapons that were being carried by his supporters to the Capitol. Paul Pelletier, a former acting chief of Department of Justice Fraud Section, said that for prosecutors, the powerful testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson might be the final nail in the legal jeopardy coffin of Trump's coterie of lawyers and enablers. He added, Hutchinson's testimony has lifted the curtain on the false narrative that the violent Capitol confrontation was spontaneous. The Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse sees a need for coordination of criminal investigations between the Department of Justice and others into the multiple efforts by Trump and key allies to block Joe Biden's win in Georgia, including Trump's call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, which is under scrutiny by the Fulton County District Attorney and a special grand jury. Sheldon Whitehouse told The Guardian, "Phony electors, the Jeffrey Clark memo and Trump's phone calls all converge on Georgia." He added, "I hope and expect that the investigations are coordinated. The raid on Jeffrey Clark shows how serious this is, and false electors could make great witnesses."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
What is the philosophy of Eid al-Adha? Imam Khamenei explains. If we pay attention to the philosophy inherent in Eid al-Adha, many paths will be open for us. A select messenger of the Righteous One, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, made a sacrifice on Eid al-Adha. In some cases, sacrificing your loved ones is beyond sacrificing your own life. Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was about to sacrifice a loved one in the way of God. A young child whom Allah the Exalted had bestowed on him at an old age after a lifetime of waiting. Praise be to Allah, who has given me in old age Ismail and Ishaq. Most surely my Lord is the hearer of prayer. The Holy Quran, Surah 14, verse 39. Allah the Exalted had bestowed these two sons on him at an old age, probably after a lifetime of impatient waiting. He had no hope of getting another child at that age. The chief of the martyrs of the entire world, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who is the symbol of sacrifice and martyrdom, remembers this event in the holy prayer of Arafah. He says, "And Ibrahim decided to sacrifice his son at an old age after a lifetime of waiting." This is part of a supplication by Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Arafah, a supplication that was recited by Hajj pilgrims on Arafah day. This sacrifice is a symbol for the faithful people who want to tread the path of truth, transcendence and perfection. This is impossible without a sacrifice. In fact, all the tests that we go through involve one essential element. All tests involve a sacrifice. Sometimes this involves sacrificing your life and wealth. Other times it involves forgiving somebody for a comment he makes and insists on stubbornly. Yet other times it involves sacrificing your dear ones, your children and your loved ones.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Being tested means going through hardships. When a hardship is placed in the way of an individual or a people, going through this hardship is a test. If they go through this hardship, they will reach the desired destination. And if they fail to utilize the talent within them, if they fail to overcome their passions, they will fall by the wayside. This is what a test is. God does not put us through divine tests in order to get to know us and see at what level we are. Divine tests are in fact a step towards one's destination. When we are tested and we manage to go through the hardships of tests, we enter a new situation, a new stage of life. A nation and an individual are not different from one another in this regard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
Microplastic contamination has been reported in beef and other meats for the first time, as well as in blood of cows and pigs on farms. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment editor Damien Carrington. The piece is titled "Microplastics Detected in Meat, Milk and Blood of Farm Animals." Microplastic contamination has been reported in beef and other meats for the first time, as well as in the blood of cows and pigs on farms. Scientists at the Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam in the Netherlands found the microplastic particles in three-quarters of meat and milk products tested and every blood sample in their pilot study. They were also found in every sample of animal pellet feed tested, indicating a potentially important route of contamination. The food products were packaged in plastic, which is another possible route. Researchers from Vrije University in Amsterdam reported microplastics in human blood for the first time in March, and they used the same methods to test the animal products. The discovery of the particles in blood shows they can travel around the body and may lodge in organs. The impact on human health or farm animal health is as yet unknown, but researchers are concerned because microplastics cause damage to human cells in the laboratory, and air pollution particles are already known to enter the body and cause millions of early deaths a year. Some wildlife is also known to be harmed by microplastics. Huge amounts of plastic waste are dumped in the environment, and microplastics have contaminated the entire planet, from the summit of Mount Everest to the deepest oceans. People were already known to consume the tiny microplastic particles via food and via water, as well as breathing them in. When you're measuring blood, you're finding out the absorbed dose from all the different exposure routes, air, water, food, etc., said Dr. Heather Leslie at the Vrije University in Amsterdam. Dr. Heather Leslie added, "So it's very interesting because it immediately tells you what's penetrating into the river of life." The pilot study was conducted to assess whether microplastics are present in farm animals, in meat, and in dairy products. It should act as an impetus to further explore the full scope of exposure and any risks that may be associated with it, said Dr. Heather Leslie. The scientists tested 12 samples of cow's blood and 12 of pig's blood, and found microplastics in all of them, including polyethylene and polystyrene. The 25 milk samples included milk from supermarket cartons, milk tanks on farms, and hand milking. 18 of the samples, including at least one of each type, contained microplastic particles. 7 of the 8 beef samples and 5 of the 8 other meat samples were contaminated. It remains unknown if there are any potential toxicological risks of these findings, the report said. Farm animals and meat have yet to be tested in other countries, but microplastic particles were reported in purchased meat in Switzerland in 2021 and in farm milk in France. Maria Westerbos at the Plastic Soup Foundation, which commissioned the new research, said, "With microplastics present in livestock feed, it is not surprising that a clear majority of the meat and dairy products tested contained microplastics. We urgently need to rid the world of plastic in animal feed to protect the health of livestock as well as the health of humans." Meanwhile, experts have told The Guardian plastic traces in animal feed could pose a risk to human health and urgently need to be the subject of more research. The comments from the experts came after British farmer Andrew Rock contacted The Guardian having noticed plastic shreds in his animal feed. Andrew Rock was told by the suppliers that this was a legal part of the recycling process that turns waste food, still packaged, into animal feed. Andrew Rock runs a small-scale pig farm in Lincolnshire and had been spotting tiny pieces of plastic in his pig's feed for several months. "In the back of my head, I thought maybe it was people dropping gloves into the feed mill. I took a kilo of scoop out of the bag and I did this over several weeks. I laid it out in the light and I found plastic in nearly every scoop." He contacted the suppliers who had sold him the feed and was shocked to discover that the fragments were not a mistake, but in fact a legal part of the recycling process that turns waste food, still packaged, into animal feed. More than 650,000 tons of unused food, from loaves of bread to Mars bars, are saved from landfill each year in the UK by being turned into animal feed. The system that strips off the plastic wrappings can't capture it all, and so in the UK, a limit of 0.15% of plastic is allowed by the Food Standards Agency. The official European Union level for plastic permitted in animal feed is zero, although in reality, many other countries operate within the same 0.15% limit.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The road to Lysychansk, the most recent city taken by the Russians, it's strewn with the debris of war and feels like a post-apocalyptic wasteland. It's the small settlement of Toshkivka. There's so much destruction, it's uninhabitable. One of a few villages we passed that may, quite literally, be wiped off the map.
Now, we're on the road to Lysychansk at the moment, but we've hit a problem. We've come to this part of the road where there's a bridge. The bridge is destroyed. So it looks like we're going to have to find another way around a detour.
The Ukrainians have blown up many such bridges in order to slow the Russian advance. We reach Lysychansk. Remarkably, much of it remains intact, as the Ukrainians gave up this city without much of a fight, although the central administration district saw the worst of the fighting.
I went outside and saw a car driving with the letter Z on it. And there was a pro-Russian militia guy. He climbed up there, took off the Ukrainian flag, and hung the Russian flag, the flag of victory. And our joy began. People came to see the flag and they were happy. They were crying, laughing, and dancing. It was great, and I still feel this joy. I think it'll remain with me forever.
A statue commemorating the fallen Soviet soldiers during World War II. Ukrainians extinguished the eternal flame in an effort to expunge Russian culture from the city. It will be lit again soon. Now the city is under Russian control.
When it was Ukraine here, we lived, somehow. There were several incidents, like my wife owned a small hairdresser's. Once a man from some nationalist battalion came and made her speak Ukrainian. He was shouting and even kicked her. They took me away for questioning a few times. It was Ukrainization here. I'm Russian, and I was born here. They were trying to force us to assimilate.
They consider people here in Donbas subhuman. I always wondered whether we had horns or something. We were second-class citizens. One Ukrainian soldier who was born only 50 kilometers away from me asked me why I hadn't left to Russia. They told us all the time to leave. But why? I've lived here all my life. My parents died here. My daughter lives here. He told me I was pro-Russian and so I should leave. They treat us with hatred.
The Russian army has set up a museum on the street. Tanks and weapons taken from the retreating Ukrainian army. There are British N-Laws and American javelins, as well as an array of drones that have increasingly become an essential part of modern warfare.
We all have to work to restore our town. Those who can't work will work. Everybody. Old-age pensioners say they'll work anywhere if it's necessary. We will rebuild our town. It'll be great.
While this war is bringing devastation to the towns and cities in which the two armies meet, it also leaves behind a desire for peace and a determination for these people to rebuild their cities and their lives. Johnny Miller, Lysychansk.
Touting South Korea's nuclear technology to allies at a recent summit in Europe, President Yoon Suk-yeol will increase the country's nuclear energy production and boost reactor sales abroad. The previous administration began to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima nuclear disaster, problems with South Korea's aging reactors, and industry corruption. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's decision to reverse course and ramp up nuclear power comes as the country faces multiple challenges to meeting its energy requirements. South Korea imports almost 100% of its oil, leaving it open to costly crude price fluctuations. And rising temperatures have increased energy demand here to record levels. The government will resume suspended reactor construction, with nuclear generating 30% of the country's energy mix by 2030. The Yoon administration says the move will help the country reach carbon neutrality and create jobs. Environmentalists decry the policy turnabout.
Nuclear technology is inherently risky, and it's also expensive, and also it's not a good solution for climate change.
South Korea ranks last in the OECD in renewable energy production, such as solar, wind, and geothermal, which activists view as offering viable alternatives.
To replace fossil fuels without increasing nuclear and provide all the electricity needed with the renewables, that's a challenge. But based on the analysis from the governmental institutions, the renewable energy potential for South Korea is enough to provide all the electricity we need.
South Korea plans to export 10 nuclear reactors by 2030, currently vying for projects planned in Poland and the Czech Republic. Officials also this week announced funding for new small modular reactor, SMR, development. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After decades of fighting, victims and the families of those impacted by the Factor VIII blood contamination scandal could be headed for compensation of sorts. In one of the darkest periods for Britain's National Health Service, a shortage of clotting agents for haemophiliacs and others suffering from other blood disorders meant the country imported blood products from the US. It later emerged the blood had been distilled from a wide range of people, including prisoners, and had been poorly screened. An investigation led by former judge Sir Brian Langstaff was announced by ex-Prime Minister Theresa May back in 2017 and seems to be finally approaching its conclusion. Earlier this month, one of the ministers at the center of the scandal, John Major, was forced to apologize after saying the victims had incredibly bad luck. Major had previously written that it was unwise to give a sympathetic view to the victims, as this might open the government up to culpability, a view that disgusts those still working with patients.
Even more damaging than the actual medical error itself, and you know, I'm a doctor, I've been involved in medical error, it's an inevitable part of life, an inevitable part of medical practice, but the attitude towards that transparency and honesty and admission of mistakes to prevent further harm being done is at the heart of good medical ethics. And what we see here is at the highest governmental level, an open admission that there was knowledge, but action wouldn't be taken either to acknowledge the error, to take steps to stop further people being infected, perhaps. And certainly, at the heart of all of this was the worry about money.
Due to medical advances and the more robust fashion in which blood products are screened before even getting to the patient, the likelihood of another Factor VIII scandal is highly unlikely. But according to experts, the race to weaken the NHS means another health crisis is just around the corner. Representatives of the current government have pledged to abide by the results and recommendation of the probe. But for many of those affected and the loved ones they've left behind, anything will be too little, too late. Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip are preparing for Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, amid dire economic conditions. The sacred Muslim occasion comes at the end of the Hajj season, and it will be observed in Palestine on Saturday. Gazans have been observing Eid al-Adha under a tight Israeli siege since 2007. Muslims around the world buy new clothes, special gifts, and sweets for the loved ones on this festive occasion, but most Gazans can't afford such luxury.
We're trying to make our children happy during Eid, but things are really tough. Most of us are just going around the markets unable to afford Eid gifts for our families. The economic situation is very bad and has been getting worse by the year due to the blockade.
People are seen browsing the merchandise lining the streets and sidewalks of Gaza and hardly buying anything. They shop for long hours to try and find